Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to Bottoming, the LGBTQ mental health podcast about rock bottoming and beyond. Kindly sponsored by Joe Malone London.
Be sure to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at BottomingPod or visit bottomingpodcast.com for more content relating to each episode.
We've also added a support page to the website to direct you to the right place if you're struggling or need someone to talk to.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe and review us on Apple Podcasts. Hi, my name is Brendan.
And my name is Matthew, and our pronouns are he and him. It's still History Month.
It's been a long month, hasn't it? Should be April by now.
It has been a long month. We released our first
two
History Month episodes, obviously at the start of the month. Mm-hmm. That is how time works. In the very first episode, we spoke to Tash and Shivani from the Logbooks podcast, which I'm sure you'll know at this point.
Absolutely. And then for episode two, we spoke to Adam Smith, who is the author of Deep Sniff, but also coincidentally is also involved in the Logbooks podcast.
Yeah, so across two episodes, we managed to chat to all of them involved. So it was really a really lovely chat with both of them, actually.
It was a treat. And also, I had a nice conversation with my mum yesterday, who was educated on poppers.
Oh.
Yeah, so we got something from it.
So as we continue History Month, we are releasing another two episodes today.
Yeah.
Special, greedy. So in the first episode that you are now listening to, we're going to speak to Christine Burns, MBE, who... Honestly, the chat was just a lovely wealth of all sorts of history and facts, and she's just so, so lovely.
Yeah.
So that was fantastic.
Yeah. If you did listen to the last two episodes, you will have heard me gush about Christine because of how stunning she was. Mm-hmm. So you get to listen to that this week.
This very episode you're listening to right now?
This one here right now, yeah. And if you stick around for part two, we speak with Saba Chowdhury, who has written the book Supporting Trans People of Colour.
And again, just another absolute pot of knowledge.
Pot? Is that a phrase?
I don't think it is the right phrase, no, but we know what I mean. But they also work with gendered intelligence as well, which we have spoken about in previous episodes. So, yeah, when you've listened to this and got your fill, have a little cup of tea, have a little break, and then get over to part two.
It's been an eventful two weeks.
It has. It really has since the last time we recorded. We recorded the day before we went off my birthday, didn't we?
Yeah.
I'm going to summarise because there's a lot that I actually can't go into detail because it is a police investigation. But we obviously recorded on the Thursday, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
Had that gorgeous cake.
Yeah.
But we went We had a really lovely night, actually. It was gorgeous. Everyone had a lot of fun in a queer venue in London. And then it just escalated into absolute chaos on the way out, involving some people that accused someone of something they didn't do. And then when questioned, they turned violent. So it resulted in three of my group being punched in the face, and I got pushed on the floor. I mean, you've known me for a lot of years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you would class me as an aggressive or violent person.
Depends on the day.
So,
No, I wouldn't.
I am trying to dance around here the words to make sure that it's, not jeopardising the criminal case at the moment and any future, also other cases that we may need to raise from it. But it actually resulted in my poor boyfriend needing to have surgery on his face. And I hope he doesn't mind me talking about this, but he's had to have plates put in his face because the people that did it badly obviously injured his face and gave him several fractures. So he is recovering well. But the last week has just been many, many hours between hospitals and police stations and people not doing the jobs correctly and having to follow things up, and then it's just been non-stop. So yeah, it is being investigated as a hate crime, which is obviously good in that sense, in one sense. But yeah, I won't talk about it anymore just because I don't want to jeopardize anything. So in summary, yeah, it's been a week, let's just say that.
Well, I think you should be comfortable because I don't think anyone will have any idea what happened based
about.
On
what, yeah. Okay.
No, for people who don't understand, why is it good that it's being treated as a hate crime?
So again, I'm being extra cautious what I'm saying because of what happened and the ignition for how it happened. It started because someone claimed something happened that didn't happen, and that was rooted in homophobia essentially. Okay. And then when questioned on that, it then turned it turned very violent, but completely unproportionate. Like, there should not have been anywhere close to anything that happened. As I say, the issue was at a queer venue, so I've got fault with the venue for the way that they handled it. I've got fault with a lot of areas in this whole thing, actually, which has just made the last week worse. So to answer your question around the hate crime, it's because it just means that the right procedures are followed in terms of how that may be investigated or prosecuted. And also, when things are logged as a hate crime, having that sort of data there should then help anything in the future when it comes to, say, planning or education or learning. So yeah, it's one of the reasons why, and obviously we've spoken about this in previous episodes, we know that a lot of LGBT people especially don't feel comfortable navigating the police system. I've not had to do it before, and it's not fun at all. I like to think that I guess know the sort of thing that should be done, but even with that, it just completely knocks your confidence, because there's so many things happening. And yeah, as I say, none of us have ever been in any situation like this before, so it's just been really intense. But to end on a positive, I will say having the people around us that we've had over the last week has just been really special. And I think especially because the birthday night out that was really fun up until the point of leaving the venue, it was bringing together different people that I don't think a lot of the people that were there have actually met one another. It was like very different groups. And as far as I know, everyone had fun. Everyone's told me they had fun, apart from that end. So yeah, that was really nice. And obviously the follow through of having that group of friends and support there has been lovely. It was also, I'm going to just give specific shout outs as well to Lapsley, who sent us some flowers over there. And also to Jamie Windust, who we interviewed back in season 2. Who, yeah, surprised us by turning up with a gorgeous gift to him for a lovely coffee. It was the first time I've actually met Jamie in person. It's only been digital. Isn't that crazy? Yeah. So yeah, specifically thank you to both of you, because, and obviously everyone else. We've been a bit overwhelmed this week, but yeah, that is it. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Better knowing you're all right and everything's okay. Yes, fine. Oh, we got a new cat.
Oh, of course.
Oh, gorgeous, gorgeous little cat. The name is changing. Often it started as Donatella. Now it's Carmella because she's quite aggressive, apparently from The Sopranos, but I've never seen The Sopranos.
I've seen The Sopranos.
But she's like a little baby. She was flea ridden when she arrived. She was and her nails were really sharp, and like she liked to scratch and bite. But we're starting to train her to only scratch and bite her toys, not the humans.
Okay, so progress.
It's progress. Yeah.
Fleas still?
No fleas.
And there was no chance you could have given them to her.
Fleas? No. Okay. Thankfully.
Good. Okay.
Fleas don't live on humans. You piece of shit.
As we mentioned at the start of this episode, we are going to be chatting to Christine Burns, MBE.
Sadly, we only had 40 minutes, otherwise we would have spoken to her for hours on end, picking her brain about her entire life, basically, yeah, which has just been one huge political campaign.
Yeah, but also doesn't see that part of it, and doesn't view the work that she's done in that way.
No.
Which is just really refreshing as well.
Admirable. She's not doing it for the likes. It's not lip service ever with Christine. No. She is all about the work.
Yeah.
So here's Christine.
My name's Christine Burns, MBE. My pronouns are she and her. And I've been knocking about on the trans activism front for somewhat over 30 years now. So I feel like I've seen it all, done it all.
So to start us off, this is LGBT History Month, February, in the UK. So what does that mean to you?
When I was first invited to get involved with LGBT History Month, which was back right at the beginning in November 2004, I'd already by then decided how important it was that people in the LGBT minorities understood the history, the things that we've been through, sort of role models of people who could inspire us, but also importantly from a political point of view, to understand the history of how we got to the place we were at. And at the end of 2004, Parliament was just about to debate the Civil Partnership Bill. It had passed the Gender Recognition Act in the summer. So this had been a really important time, and that had really brought home to me how important it was to understand the context. Mm. And since I'd been involved by that time for about 12 years and understood what we'd done to get where we had got, I was also really scared that because so much of it was actually done in a fledgling online form and with a community online that couldn't possibly represent all the people we were fighting for, there was a generation that was coming up who might never actually really appreciate how it was that the rights that they were suddenly acquiring had actually come about.
This month, we've kind of gone, you know, we've had a few of them, especially they get bigger every year as corporates and different organisations get involved. But it is a great time to reflect on where we've come from, as you mentioned, and also the work that has been done by many, many people to get us where we are today, including yourself. So thank you. Okay. Can you talk about some of the amazing work that you've done with the Press for Change campaign? And also you mentioned again the Gender Recognition Act, but the involvement in helping draft that as well.
Christine, would you please tell us your life story? No, actually,
just a small question.
I transitioned sometime before I got involved in activism. And according to the advice at the time, what you were supposed to do was to transition, to get the surgeries and things that you needed, and then disappear into society and live in what trans people called stealth. Because without secure rights to employment and other things that keep you safe, the safest thing you could do as a trans person was for people to not know you were a trans person. So I got involved partly because I'd realised that even being hidden like that was no protection. I'd had problems with a car insurance. I was shortly to go on and have problems with a health insurance. But so I realised that we couldn't just leave things as they were. And it seemed like a very auspicious time as well, because in 1986, a trans man called Mark Rees had become the first trans person to take Britain to the European Court of Human Rights over two very key rights. One is the right to private life and correspondence, that's Article 8, and the other is the right to marry. And at the time, and this was very ironic for a government that was about to pass Section 28, barristers for the UK were arguing in court at Strasbourg that Mark wasn't denied the right to marry because the law saw him as a woman and he could marry a man. So they were openly advocating that this man with a deep voice and a big beard and obviously a man should marry another man because that kept their ledgers tidy. So he went to court in 1986. He didn't win, but he started a really important conversation, and he got people thinking about, you know, the way they'd never thought before that trans people had problems, because we were unfortunately invisible by our own hand, that people started to see that this was a tremendous injustice. And then about 3 years later, in 1989, a trans woman called Caroline Cossey, also known as the Model Tula, also took an almost identical case to the European Court of Human Rights. And she looked as if she was going to win, and then she lost, but on a very much smaller difference of opinion between judges. So it was clear that there was things were moving in the direction that was favourable to us. And also the big thing we all took out of this was that this was a place where you could actually have people listen to the truth of these injustices. We couldn't go to the press. The press thought we were just fodder to sell newspapers on Sundays in tabloids. We couldn't go to MPs, because at the time we didn't think there's any MP would think that there were votes in campaigning for these strange tiny minority of people who thought, people thought we were perverts. So to actually realize that the courts don't do fake news. They're interested in the facts. And the facts were pretty clear that we were really suffering indignities and, denial of our rights by the status quo. And so there was something that could be done. Mm. And for about 25 years up until that point, we hadn't thought there was anything that could be done. It was hopeless. This was the status quo. Now, if you were trans and you transitioned, then this was just what you had to accept. And it was clear that it needn't be, and that there was a place for an activist group to be formed. Mm. Now, I wasn't there at the very beginning of this, but some of my colleagues and friends were, in setting up this thing called Press for Change, at the recommendation of the Liberal Democrat Home Affairs spokesman at the time, whose name momentarily escapes me. I'll be back with that in a moment. Alex Carlyle, yes.
You got it.
Small fact, he also defended Paul Burrell, Princess Diana's butler.
But oh, that's, interesting.
But that's very interesting. A little throwaway sprat. but he was right. And he said, you need to go away. You need to set up a campaign. You won't get there fast. It'll probably take you about 10 years. He said that in 1990. And he was pretty right, because we actually got where we needed to get to legally by about 2002. So he wasn't far out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I got involved the following year, when I kept bumping into one of the founders at international conferences. And he said, oh, do you want to come along to one of our meetings and see what you can do with us? And that's how I got involved in Press for Change back in 1993. Now, in those days, we were very small. People weren't on the internet, because to the public, there wasn't an internet. There was certainly not a World Wide Web. These things, I was an IT consultant. I could see these things on the horizon. And our problem as a campaign in those days was we probably had about 1,000 people on paper mailing lists. And if we wanted to send a newsletter, we could do that, but you had to print the newsletter. Mm. Then you had to have a party in somebody's house to fold the newsletter, stuff it in an envelope, stick a label on, stick stamps on it, and send it out. And that was an extreme, you know, if you're sending 1,000 first-class mailings, that's £250.
Yeah.
So it was not that you could do very often, and you couldn't very move very fast.
Mm.
And I was saying to my colleagues, look, this thing has just come along. Initially, the World Wide Web was like being able to make your own brochure electronically. It didn't have much more to it than that. But we could take news, we could take legal judgments, and we could put them online and we could explain them to people.
Mm.
And slowly we could actually create a body of people who understood why there was a case for campaigning for our rights. And that sort of grew our strength. And they were saying to me, oh, Christine, well, it's all right. You've got bags of money and you can afford these things, but other people can't buy computers. And then along came Amstrad with a cheap personal computer, which blew that argument out of the water as well. And so, and I just had this feeling that if we build it, they will come. Yeah. And that's how we sort of came to be. We really started to move to strength when more and more people came online.
Mm.
And I had a fantastic colleague called Claire, who was much better at programming things than I was. And so we had a partnership. I wrote the copy for the website, and she maintained the system and promoted it. And then she created an email list server so we could send news very quickly to people. And the first time we put that into action was in the beginning of 1997.
Wow.
And oh no, it was in 1998, because we'd had a Labour government by then.
Mm.
And we'd also won a very important judgment in the European Court of Justice, which said that trans people were covered by the Equal Treatment Directive as far as our employment rights were concerned, and therefore we had the same rights as anybody else did under the Sex Discrimination Act. And the government, that this new Labour government wanted to actually formally incorporate that into the law, but they wanted to do it in a way that actually stripped away a lot of the things we'd just won. And so they set up a consultation, and we used this new tool. By this point, we've got about 200 people online. And I remember scanning this document, this consultation document, and then proofreading it and sending it out to all these people with our new tool, and just getting them motivated to say, I'm not going to tell you what to say, but read this and then write to this address about how it impacts you. And then also go and see your MP.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, some more snail mail oriented colleagues were doing the same thing in the paper correspondence. So we got this thing out very fast, and the government didn't know what hit it. So they'd never done a consultation before with the public, and they thought this thing would be really easy. You just make these regulations, you stick them in front of Parliament, say
and then maybe a couple of people writing, and that's it.
And they had 300 responses where they had expected none.
Yeah,
and it just it blew them off the rails. And in fact, the whole process stopped for a year while they licked their wounds and thought, how do we go about dealing with this? But the effect it had for us was that it got us an opportunity to talk to senior civil servants, because eventually we were invited to go and meet the minister as well, Margaret Hodge. And I remember being in a room with her over lunch. I said to my boss, because we had an office in London, I said, I'm just going to be a little bit longer for lunch today, Keith. He said, well, why? Where are you going? And somewhere nice to eat. I said, no, I'm going off to meet the employment minister. So I remember sitting through an hour with her and being, I felt, I've only got one shot at this. And so I was fairly robust in defending what we needed to secure in this legislation. I remember when we left, I looked back and she was, This is a woman who terrorizes the captains of industry. She was leaning back on her desk going, and going down the list, I said, look, you know, we'd like to talk to your other colleagues in other ministries, because a lot of government at that time wasn't on email.
Yeah.
Sometimes we tried to guess their email addresses. and other times we just had to write to them with bits of paper and stamps.
Mm.
And so we began to open the door to being listened to and for them to understand that we were people they could do business with.
Mm.
You know, I was, by day, I was a senior consultant with an international IT consultancy company.
Mm.
People paid thousands of pounds a day for my time. Why shouldn't a government listen to me and my colleagues? And so we had an in, and we actually began to be in the position of being able to move things forward a little bit at a time, so that, and all that time, my colleague Stephen Whittle was helping bring forward additional cases in the European Court of Human Rights. We had another one in 1998, which unfortunately, again, we lost, but only by one vote. If one judge had voted the other way, we would have won at that time.
Wow.
And then there was another one in 2002. And by this point, the European Court of Human Rights was just thoroughly pissed off with Britain. the only polite way to put it was that they've been told over and over, this is very complicated, we're looking at it, it finally balanced points and so on, and we're going to come up with something. And they hadn't. It was all bleh.
Yeah.
So they finally said, well, okay, it's time to rule on this. And so they unanimously ruled in favour of these plaintiffs who've taken their cases in 2002. And consequently, the government then had to bring forward some legislation. And I remember us getting the call and saying, would you like to come in and talk to us? And so we went to this meeting with a very senior civil servant in St. James's House, opposite St. James's Station. And they brought out the nicest crockery and gorgeous chocolate biscuits. And I thought, we're in here.
I love a chocolate biscuit, yeah.
So we then spent 2 years working, a lot of it at the time in enforced secrecy, on how to create what became the Gender Recognition Act. We didn't get all the things we wanted at the time. But, yeah, I often liken it to how we got to the equal age of consent for lesbians and gays as well, that, you know, that first it was 1967, it was 21, then it was 18, and only finally did we get to 16. So politics is often the art of what you can manage to achieve at the time and be prepared to come back and fix some of those bits later. Mm. So that's why I wasn't surprised when another generation, you know, 10 years later, wanted to say, it's time to update the Gender Recognition Act.
Mm.
You know, please don't be offended, Christine. See, No, we're not. You know, what kept you so long?
Yeah.
So I can't remember what your original question was, but I think I've answered it.
100%. Oh, really? Honestly, yeah. It's so fascinating, especially, I think it's quite easy for, as you mentioned now, obviously now a big conversation is around the Gender Recognition Act again. And I think it's really easy to just see what has happened before as like an abstract thing. Like, you know, it is there, it exists. But without speaking to people and listening to people that were there doing it on the ground, it's really difficult to, I think, imagine how it was. And I think those stories are needed to reinvigorate what we're doing today as well.
It comes back to your previous question, why is LGBT History Month important?
Yeah.
Because you're right, that there's a whole generation now to whom that's just, it's just called the Gender Recognition Act 2004.
And that's it, it's always been that way.
Yeah, how it happened is a whole story. So I built a memoir around it. So
yeah.
So also, for those who are listening and don't know, you also edited the book Trans Britain, Our Journey from the Shadows.
On your shelf, gorgeous.
There we are. Gorgeous cover. What was this process like, pulling together all these different stories and voices?
Well, I hadn't originally intended to write it or produce it, because I'd done, in 2013, I'd done a two-part book called Pressing Matters, which was the inside story of what I've just told you.
Mm-hmm.
It was the nuts and bolts about how you build a campaign and how we came to be in the position we were in the middle of 2004 with the Gender Recognition Act. So I thought I'd done that. Mm. And then a couple of years later, in 2016, a publisher who I knew quite well said, you know, could you do us another book? And I said, well, yeah, I'll go away and think about it. And I thought, well, I can't replicate that format.
Yeah.
And I rationalized doing that previous one on the basis of I'll somehow weave it around my own memoir as mm-hmm. well, so that there's a reason to tell it. So I can't do that. So I can't make myself the first voice in the book. And so I thought, how else? And also, a lot of this stuff, there is no official evidence for, because for all the time since the early 1950s, the press has regularly lied about us. It's painted us in a particular way. So you, as historians, you won't ever get anything useful, really, from the mainstream media.
Mm.
So I thought, well, I've got an address book packed with people. And I know that so-and-so was there when that happened, and so-and-so was there, and so-and-so was an expert on such and such. So I thought, maybe we can do this as an anthology.
Mm.
So I built a timeline for all the things that actually happened from really about the mid-1960s, which was when the first support group for trans people was formed, the Beaumont Society, and how people met up in those days or where were safe places to go, and then took that forwards until around about the time that the book was being written in 2016, 2017, and then picked out people who could tell those stories. And it very soon became apparent that there were three major subdivisions to this story. There was a period of time when, well, actually four if you count the period before the 1960s, mm-hmm. when trans people, you were on your own, mm. But we existed. Mm. But certainly there was this time of the growth of self-support organisations, and that was a really important period. And it shocked me to realise that it lasted really from 1965 until we got to activism in 1990.
Mm.
So it was 25 years. Now, that was all we had. It was all about other trans people meeting and telling you how to avoid getting arrested by the police, or how to avoid getting sacked, and all the how-to is about how to survive. Mm. So then we had this period that started around about 1990, 92, which was activism. And that went on for initially with us for about 15 or 16 years. I retired from that campaign in 2007. And all the things we did were from the same team in that period of time. And then you get this period from 2007 until nearly the present day, when it was really apparent that there was a whole new generation that had come up. And one of the reasons I retired was to make sure that they didn't feel that they were constrained by having to ask for permission to do things.
Mm.
I thought, really importantly for our community, was that people should actually now build a whole new structure, have new specialists, have new stars or whatever, so that they could take forward the things that needed to be done after we'd largely done the legislation. Because the legislation is important. It provides the security. To me, for instance, the fact that I couldn't be sacked just for being trans, it was an important piece of security to be able to do activism and to be able to safely say to my boss, I'm off to see the employment minister. Yeah. Too many questions. So that gave me three pieces of book. And then I needed to string it together. So I wrote some sections in between. But largely, I gave a fairly simple brief to each person I'd picked out. And I think there were 22 people in the end. And said, can you write about this? touching on these things, but you know, I'm not going to give you any more brief than that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't tell them what other people were writing. They were writing just about the bit they were asked to do. And that's a really key part of it, I think, because completely unaware of what everybody else was writing, they managed to write chapters that mesh together really well. Because in historical terms, if a number of people write about the same thing, mm-hmm. and they are all in agreement without having compared notes, then you can say,
yeah,
right, that bit of history is nailed down.
Yeah.
Sometimes, there were quite a few different opinions about an early doctor who provided the gender identity clinic in the 1960s and early 1970s. And people had really different views on him. And I thought, oh, well, that's work for future historians to delve into that.
Definitely.
Because obviously
you've had different experiences.
That's more complicated.
Yeah.
So that's how it worked. And it worked out remarkably well. Not everybody stuck to their word count. But
awesome.
Yeah, can you write me 3,000 words? Became here's 7,000 words. Oh, well, thank you. And that's the hardest thing, actually, is to try and take a knife and cut out this. We're lovely, but actually
you've
didn't
got to be straight.
Serve. That's right. Because what I wanted to do is I wanted to produce a book that wasn't just for trans people.
Yeah.
Anybody could read it. So there weren't any terms that weren't explained mm-hmm. or obvious. There was no wagging of fingers because mm-hmm. people were telling it like it was. And generally speaking, I thought it made history approachable. Because it was all about human lives. I remember the one thing that went wrong for me was I said to them all, I'd like you to write in the second person about, you know, so you're a narrator saying what happened, like an expert historian.
Yeah.
Not one of them did. It was all, I did this, I did that. So I gave in on that one. I thought, okay, this is how it's going to work. And actually, I'm glad they did, because I think the book is better for that, because it is very personal.
Yes, completely.
So, I mean, as well as obviously two books, you also produced the podcast, is that right? 10 years
ago?
Just over 10 years ago?
Longer than that, actually. I remember we were always trying out new things with the Press for Change online platform.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very keen. In the early days, I'd said to my colleagues, you know, we're going to be going out on behalf of people mm-hmm. who don't know us.
Yeah.
So I want to put our pictures on there. I want to put our profiles on there. I want people to know mm-hmm. who's speaking for them.
Build that trust.
But then as time progressed, I also thought, really, they should be able to hear who we are as well, because there was no YouTube in 2005. That didn't come along till 2006, so we couldn't do that. Most people were on dial-up modems. So even if we were going to do audio, we had a constraint that the audio had to fit 8 megabytes. So it could be downloaded in a reasonable time.
Wow.
But also the widget that we had on the screen when you click to play could also only handle an 8 megabyte file. So if you ever go to those recordings and think they sound like medium wave on a bad night, that's why. we kept turning down the bitrate until the file fitted 8 megabytes. So those are the early days of just trying to get stuff out there. And often, quite often, there was no commentary. It was just a speech I'd given or an essay I'd read, and I spoke it to the microphone, just so that people had that little bit extra to understand about us. The other thing was, at the time I started it, not even the word podcast had been coined. I think it was Apple who coined the word when they relaunched iTunes in 2005, and they added this facility to support podcasts. And so when I wanted to do this, I had a terrible trouble trying to get hold of equipment. I managed to buy a vocal microphone. That was it. That was no problem.
Yeah.
And then, how am I going to get my speech into MP3 format, into digital format? So I looked around and I finally found a machine which could record direct to digital form.
Mm-hmm.
Cost £550. It was my Christmas present to myself.
Oh, wow!
So I had this equipment, and it took too much power to be able to work on its batteries. So I had to take this enormous charge with me as well. But it would enable me to get out. But then when I'd left Press for Change, I still wanted to do some more of this. And by that point, in late 2007, we were beginning to see the emergence of the first podcast platforms. I discovered there was this thing called Podbean, and that seemed to work. Some of the facilities were very crude, but I could make it work.
Yeah.
And then that worked quite well. And then the following year, I bought, I bought a much smaller recorder.
Oh, yes.
It was designed for, musicians to audition themselves.
Oh, and
you know, when you're
so
when you're just
quality.
Plucking away and you get a riff,
yeah.
You don't want to forget it. You've recorded it, and this produced fantastic sounding. It also came with a digital audio workstation, so I could by this point I could now have a signature tune and I could talk over it, do these things, you know, as well as editing. Trying to convince people to try these things out, you know, so what's the point? How does it work? And I'd left podcasting before it became popular.
Yeah.
and there were ways and means for people to make money for it from it if they wanted. But it was a great time because, again, it comes back to history.
Mm-hmm.
What I found I wanted to do, because although I ostensibly with just Plain Sense, the name of the podcast, I was trying to cover the whole area of equality and diversity. So all the equality strands, I had stories on everything.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones that really interested me the most were the opportunity to talk to significant figures in trans, not just as campaigners, but also other figures as well. So I got a fantastic interview with Adele Anderson, a fascinating Aida. And there was Calpurnia Adams from America coming over to London. We got a fantastic. It was horrible because I was asking her questions about the murder of her boyfriend. And I've never felt more the responsibility of a journalist than actually asking her to go through that on mic.
Yeah.
But she tells it so well. And then there were people like Nadia.
Mm-hmm.
Nadia was absolutely brilliant to interview. Mm. So over the years, and of course, campaigners like Stephen and Mark as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there was plenty of material. I think I did about 100 episodes in the end. And then because I was retiring from work as well, and it was work that provided the excuse for me to have the podcast, that it was time to wind that up, and again hope that I'd inspired other people to go on and do the same thing. And nowadays, you know, I've lost count of how many podcast interviews I've given. And this is a lot easier because I just rattle on and you have to edit it. It's great. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean the systems have become a lot more streamlined as well. Yeah. But I mean, like you said, in terms of LGBT History Month, it's all those episodes are still there. People can still go back and listen to them. There's, like you said, this anthology of 90 plus episodes, and all of the conversations you were having are still incredibly important to the history that has happened. So yeah, everyone should go check that out if they haven't already. But thinking of now, I guess, the future and where you kind of see the world going, what further change do you hope to see for trans people in the UK? That's a big question.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose it's predicated on the fact that I'd like to see us get past this awful period of time with this really artificially confected moral panic. Because nothing about this moral panic is based on any truth. It's based on a series of lies. We seem to be in a period of history where lying passes as being okay as a political tactic, you know, whether it's in the US, who are at least now actually really dealing with the fact that they've been, you know, subjected to a system that was based on lies for now 6 years, and they're getting towards nailing the people responsible, but also in Britain, where, you know, we were not so long ago, about 5 or 6 years ago, we were regarded as one of the most advanced countries in the world in terms of LGBT rights, mm-hmm. and deservedly so. I guess, you know, by the time I was actually starting to think of doing Trans Britain, I thought, actually, you know, this was a good time to do a celebratory retrospective of our history, mm-hmm. because we'd gone through the worst, and yeah. we, you know, there were lots of social changes that still needed to be done. But it was, you know, it was all positive stuff, and I anticipated that it would carry on being good. You know, we had mm-hmm. trans people, you know, starring in films on Netflix and, you know, everywhere. You know, there were trans models everywhere. There were trans political candidates. You know, at the first few pages of Trans Britain, I've just gone on a splurge of naming people and saying, you know, this is where we were. And at the time that Time magazine said, I think in 2015, this is the trans tipping point, you know, that's finally trans people are visible mm-hmm. and, you know, respected and making progress. And I guess that was probably the red rag to the bull as far as the you know, the Conservatives were concerned, because yeah. not Conservatives as in Conservative Party, mm-hmm. but Conservatives as in terms of right-wing evangelicals. Mm. So I think, you know, we are in the throes of a big strop by a particular political group, which has roots all around the world, but particularly in Britain and America. And we've had the kind of low-rent politicians who thought that anything that divides people, anything that gets people arguing, benefits them. Mm. Because as long as we're divided, you know, on whether it was Brexit, nearly 50-50, whether it was on trans people or whatever, that's good for them, because we're not scrutinizing them, mm-hmm. and they can get on with doing the bad things that they want to do, which turned out to be, you know, plundering the bank. I hope that this sort of pattern continues, in the sense that, as you know, the shackles go on to the ringleaders in America, that we will actually start to mop up what's happened in Britain, and then survey the wreckage. Because it breaks my heart that as a country we've brought ourselves so low in such a short space of time, and in service of nothing but lies. People have trashed their reputations to dunk on the trans. I'm not going to name names, because everybody knows.
People know.
So, yeah, there's going to be lots of PhDs further down the road, and there's probably a lot of, you know, psychological study, I think, to be made of how it is, generally speaking, that people get reeled into conspiracy theories, you know, whether it's QAnon or gender critical, whatever. I can't see to the sunlit uplands in the future, to answer your question, until we've won the war and can take stock of, because we've got a generation of damage in front of us. You know, if it stopped today, then there are people who have been harmed by what has happened, people who are scarred. People, families broken by the rifts that are created by, you know, you've got a gender critical person in your family, everybody sort of moves away from them, because they're the mad uncle or aunt. And there's, yeah, there is, they've managed, thank God, not to change any laws. But they've tried all the ways around the side to try and have the same effect. You know, they have promulgated a lie about what the Equality Act says and does, and what the Gender Recognition Act says and does, and you know, that's an alternative to passing laws on a, you know, if you want to change the law, then do it in the proper way, and get everybody to vote for it. Don't do it by creating an alternative reality where people believe that the law says something else.
yeah, I mean, we've covered over the last 18 months, especially the way the media have been. Yeah. I think, yeah, as you said, we don't need to name people because I think people that are listening to this podcast especially already know.
They're litigious bastards anyway.
But to end this fantastic chat, who do you think are the up and coming or the trans voices that we should be listening to and paying attention to right now?
Oh goodness, there's so many of them. I think there's a big difference in that in my day we had one leading organization and everybody knew who we were. I thought that's one of the things that would replace us. But actually what's happened is we've got smaller organizations or individuals who are absolute stars. You know, one that comes to mind is Katie Montgomery, brilliant podcaster or YouTuber, and very well spoken, very intelligent. Sean Fay, you know, I spend as much time promoting her book as I do plugging my own. So the transgender issue, it's brilliant. I'm so jealous. I wish I'd thought of some of the things that she's written. But that's the good thing about being an old and crusty old woman is that, you know, the younger generation actually are better than us. Rather than getting grumpy about it, and I think so much of what's going on at the moment is about people of my generation, baby boomers, who don't like the fact that the world has changed and it's not their plaything anymore. And they just hate the fact that young people are doing it better. You know, I've grown up through all this stuff. And what it's done to me, rather than making me bitter and twisted, is to make me enthusiastic about the things, you know, the best way of paying respect to what Stephen and Claire and myself did for Press Change is to do well as a trans person and be a really good advocate. Or another one, Philosophy Tube, what's her name? I can't remember. Abigail Thorne. She's another brilliant.
I don't think I know of her.
No.
Oh, you should check her out. She's got a whole oeuvre of YouTubes. She actually teaches philosophy via her YouTube. And she transitioned.
She looks very familiar.
Yeah, I do.
In the middle of being a YouTube star, which I think is so cool.
I remember.
These are ones I'm just grabbing from the air.
I know that was a big question.
I know only as Twitter handles. You know, I've always
that was
made
why
it
I didn't
point.
Recognize Abigail's name. I know her face from the picture, but I don't know the handle.
So, you know, I've always had this thing that when people wrote to us at Press for Change, I didn't ask them to give me a description of what they were. They just told me what their problem was. And I pointed them in the direction of somebody who could help. And years later, I might meet somebody and think, oh, goodness, you're nothing like what I imagined. You can't stop yourself imagining. But it didn't matter. It meant that our justice was blind to the sort of things that can, you know, lead you down prejudices. And so similarly, particularly the parents representing their trans kids. They have very good reasons to need to be anonymous. So I know them only as their Twitter handles. Some of them have come and introduced themselves to me and said, don't tell me your name. I don't want to know. just I love what you do. And I would just know you as Dad Trans or Mini Mum or whatever. I think that makes us more robust and resilient as well, because, thinking back, you know, if we'd faced the sort of opposition that's out there today, I don't think we'd have stood a chance. But trans people being this informal network, I don't understand. You know, it isn't planned. It isn't architected. It's just there. This group of people who all share, because it's our life experience, all share the knowledge of what we need to do to put the world right. And that is enough in common for people to work together and achieve that. And it's, you know, it's inspiring. I've often thought, you know, when is the point when it's decent for me to log off and just wander away and do the garden or whatever? Because I'm getting on a bit here. I can't, because I'd be missing it. It's so damned exciting to watch. So I am. I hope they realise how much in awe I am of all of them. And why I try to put down people's attempts to stick Stephen or myself or whoever on a pedestal. No, we were just ordinary trans people using whatever talents we got at the time. And we were just, you know, looking around and thinking, oh, there's nobody else to do this, we better do it. But now this is wonderful. And that's what makes us unstoppable. I think the meanies are losing already. I don't think some of them realise it yet, but I already see a slow switch of the tide.
Yeah.
And I think that will gather speed. And, you know, as people get to be curious, aware of previously, they sort of thought this is too dangerous a world, you know, thing to go for, then, you know, our books are going to be there to help them, as they've been all along.
As you said at the start, honestly, I could listen to Christine for hours.
And you can go to Apple Podcasts, get on her podcast, Just Plain Sense, and you can listen to her for hours on end.
And also she recommended, she didn't recommend, she told us about her own book, and also some other books that you should read this history month. So, as always, we will link to them in the episode bio, or we'll link to her socials on the episode bio, and also check out the website at bottomingpodcast.com.
Beautiful. We'll leave you here for now. Gather your thoughts, have a think, write down some things, write down some notes, and then go on to episode 2. You will be tested.
And you can follow Christine on Twitter
at Christine Burns CHR.
No, we don't need to, that's fine. Perfect.
Cool. We'll see you
on part 2. Bye for now.
When your skin feels nourished and glows, you radiate confidence. Osea makes giving your skin a glow-up easy with their clean, clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This seaweed-powered duo features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OSEAMalibu.com, code GLOW.